series of talks given this week. This afternoon we come to the end of the journey, the final two steps of liberative dependent arising. And the final steps are liberation and knowledge of what has been left behind, knowledge of what has been destroyed or let go of in being liberated. And it's a beautiful thing, it's an amazing thing that when there's so much suffering in the world, so much despair and sadness and violence we do to each other, that it's possible for a human being to reach down into the depths of their hearts, depths of their beings, and pull out what the tradition calls the roots for suffering, the roots for harming behavior, whether we're harming others or harming ourselves. And one of the definitions of someone who is liberated is that they do not cause harm to oneself or cause harm to others. And then actually it continues and says they do not cause harm to self or others. And I'm not sure what that means, but I like to think it means we don't even cause harm to us as a community, to society. So this idea of not causing harm, and another way of saying it, is not being in conflict. My first time in Thailand, I met elderly, for me, I was young then, but he seemed elderly. Well, probably younger than I am now. And it was the first time I met a meditator who really impressed me, like, wow. I looked into his eyes and like there was like some depth there that I hadn't seen before or something. And he talked about his meditation experience. I'd never heard until that time someone who had these kinds of experiences. So I was really impressed by this man. So I asked him, in your years of being a monastic, a practitioner, what have you attained? And he said, non-contention. He could have said, oh, blissful experiences and great, you know, cosmic union with whatever, you know. Oneness. But he said something more profound for, I think, an individual and more profound for our society. Non-contention, or non-conflict. So to be liberated in such a way that you're no longer in conflict with anything, including yourselves. It's quite a phenomenal undertaking. So we have this capacity. It's a beautiful capacity, and the Buddhist tradition refers to it as a noble capacity, the noble quest, a dignified endeavor, a dignified attainment to come to a place of non-conflict. And I'm fond of this idea that the Buddhism looks upon each of us as with a certain degree of capacity for nobility, as being noble, as being somehow dignified human beings. Sometimes when people hear this teachings of not-self, it's like you're supposed to not count. You're supposed to kind of like wither away, and better if no one notices you. But the example of this fellow behind me up here, the Buddha, he's, the way that posture is not someone who's like not-self and kind of like, where is he? You know, it's like no one there. I mean, that's a pretty solid, confident, strong kind of presence. Dignified. And non-contentious. And the kind of the symbolism of that statue is, he's kind of rooted and upright and strong, but he's not leaning forward and not pulling back. Just here, in the moment. So liberation. In the sense that we're coming to the end of the journey, and the journey kind of begins, kind of with suffering, but it really begins with faith. Faith is such an important quality. And I want to emphasize there, again, something that's so beautiful, the role, the faith, the possibility of sincerity, of confidence, of inspiration, of some deep trust in a path of practice, trust in oneself and one's capacity to come to a place of non-conflict, of freedom. And to have a kind of wholehearted or a wholesome, you know, faith and trust and sincerity in the path and the possibility and the engagement is one of the really great treasures of a human life. And it's such a great treasure that it almost doesn't matter if you practice after that. I mean, it's just so great. It's just like that's a turning point in a life to really have profound faith and confidence. Yes, there's a practice. There's a way of meeting this life. There's a way of waking up. And yes, it is possible. A friend of mine, a Zen teacher, Lou Richman, was a student of Suzuki Roshi in the 1960s. And he asked Suzuki Roshi once, if I do this Zen practice, will I get enlightened? It's a reasonable question. And Suzuki Roshi said, if your practice is sincere, it's almost as good. Almost as good, if your practice is sincere. So who knows what degree of awakening, freedom, liberation you'll reach in your lifetime, but you'll certainly reach something, no doubts about it. And maybe it's not going to look like the fullest possible kind of liberation, but if your practice is sincere, it's almost as good. So the idea of faith, sincerity, confidence, trust, kind of a willingness to give yourself over, or willingness to kind of be, you know, not be afraid. They say that when a person has real trust in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, real confidence in this path, there's no more reasons to complain. Isn't that nice? Or now you're going to leave it. I mean, forget Buddhism now. I mean, that's too big of a sacrifice. But you know, no more reason to complain. That's quite something to have. You know, what kind of faith, what kind of confidence would lead a person to say, no more reason to complain? So it starts kind of with this faith or confidence and moves along. That's what we've been talking about this retreat. And then there's the disenchantment, breaking the spell. And then there's the fading away. And to me, there's something very mature about approaching the whole path of freedom as partly as a fading away of our attachments, our clinging, the fetters, the chains we have with us, the way we're contracted and in prison. And what's mature about it is that it's realistic. It's like kind of willing to kind of do the work. It's willing to show up and be there and go through the process, as opposed to the instant enlightenment kind of idea, which is a beautiful thing. And there are kind of momentary experiences which are quite profound and meaningful. But to kind of put all your eggs in that basket and like huff and puff and wait and hope, and I don't think it's a very mature or very respectful kind of process. The respectful process is to understand it takes a while, it takes time. The Dalai Lama was giving a teaching at some big auditorium, maybe in Arizona many years ago, and I knew people who were there. And he had time for questions and answers, and some man stood up and wanted to know something like, what is the fastest way to get enlightened? It's reasonable, we're in America. And we have important things to do. It'd be very efficient just to get enlightenment over with so you can do these, you know, all these good all things you should do, right? So he said, what's the fastest way? And apparently the Dalai Lama's response was quite moving to the people who were there. At first he didn't respond. He just stood there. And then he started crying. And then he said that something about this thing about, you know, this idea to be in a hurry, to look for the fastest way, somehow is not what it's about. It doesn't really respect the whole process, doesn't really respect the depth and the fullness of the path and our humanity. And I can imagine, you know, for me, also not only our shared humanity, how we live together, and this idea that we would engage with faith and sincerity and, like, do the work and let it take as long as it takes, so that it becomes real, it becomes ours, it becomes, you know, it has a chance to flower within us. So this is a fading away. Let it fade away. Let it take its time. Don't be in a hurry. Don't look for the magic pill that's going to do it once and for all. But there is then at some point liberation. And there are different kinds of liberation. And some of them are the simple releases that we have maybe throughout the day. And some of them are quite big, or some of the major sources of clinging, of grasping, of resistance, of the knots we have inside finally get untied. And you would think that liberation should be the end of the path. Kind of like, why isn't there 11 steps, not 12? Stop with liberation, you know, full liberation. That should be good enough. But it ends with knowledge. Knowledge of what has been left behind. Knowledge of what's been let go of or been destroyed or evaporated. And I understand it a little bit this way. A couple of different reasons why this knowledge is very important to have, not just liberation. If you're lost in the wilderness and you're trying to find your way out, you could wander around and around for weeks and months and years, and then somehow, kind of when you're not paying attention, stumble out of the wilderness and you're, well, there you are, back in civilization, downtown Market Street, finally. And so you're back, you're found, you know. And that's nice, to be out of the wilderness, no longer lost. But if you don't reflect on what just happened, or if you didn't kind of really pay attention, you might not have learned the way out of the wilderness. So if, lo and behold, you end up falling back in the wilderness again, you're not any wiser, and you're not going to find your way out again. It's going to be by luck again, just wandering around hoping you can get out. Or you get out, and, you know, your friend calls you and says, you know, I'm stuck in the wilderness and lost. I have no way out. And, you know, how do you do it? I don't know. You just wander around for months and years and decades, and if you're lucky, you'll just kind of stumble out, you know. I mean, that's not very helpful. But if you understand the way, if you understand the path, you understand where the exit is, or you understand where the freedom is found, then it might help you in the future when you find yourself stuck and caught, and it might help you, might allow you to help other people because you know something about the way. So this idea that for our own sake and for the sake of our society, having some knowledge and understanding of the process, what's the process, how does this unfold? What's the inner workings of my life, that's why I understand it, so I can find my way out of the wilderness of the heart, the term that the Buddha used, the wilderness of the heart. And another reason for an understanding, recognizing that you're liberated and what you're liberated from, is that it gives you a very important piece of information that you can use to catch yourself in the future. So what I mean by this is that, say that you've always been carrying tension somewhere in your body. Maybe your stomach's always been in a knot. But it's habituated. It's been so common for you. It's been there all your life that you just never occurred to you that it's not normal. It's every, you know, so this is what it means to be human, is to have this tight, twisted sensation in the belly. And probably everyone has it. I mean, that, you know, just comes with the territory. And so you happily, contentedly live your life with this knot in your stomach. And then you come on a retreat. And lo and behold, that knot dissolves for a few hours. That's important piece of information. Wow. I had no idea. I had no idea it was a knot. I thought it was just like, this is what stomachs are. There's an alternative. There's another way. It's possible not to have the knot. And then we know something we didn't know before. And we have a kind of a guiding star, a North Star. This is possible. I don't know how long it's going to take again to undo that knot, but now I know it's possible. It happened once, I think it can happen again. And the cost of living with this knot, now I see it's too much. No wonder I'm always tired, or no wonder, whatever. And so I think that I will, now I'm going to set out on a path of practice. Some people have that kind of release of a knot before they come to like a practice like Buddhism through a variety of things. You know, some people, like in their golden age of something, it was LSD. And I met a man once who was stuck in, got caught in an avalanche, submerged in an avalanche in Nepal, and under the snow, and couldn't get out, and was sure he was going to die. And when he thought he had only, you know, it was coming to the end, he let go. And he felt so peaceful, like he felt this peace and this subtleness that he never had in his life. It was so dramatic for him. And then to his surprise, at the same time, involuntarily, he said, he just didn't know what was going on, his arm pushed up through the snow and into the surface. He wasn't buried that deep. So he survived. And but that experience changed his life. And so then he started practice. Or a friend of mine who worked as an electrician on a TV set, and he got electrocuted. And it seemed like the electrocution kind of like wiped out every defilement he had, every tension, everything. And like he was so happy and so clear and so wonderful, and he just went through life, you know, and happily, and all his troubles were gone, and his social relationships kind of cleared up, and he met a woman, and they got together, and it was all happily and great for about 6 months. And then whatever the effect of the electricity did began to wear off, and after 6 months they were divorced, and you know, it was kind of, you know, a sad story in the end. He tasted something. And that changed his life, and he's been a practitioner ever since. I think it's about over 25 years. So there can be big things like that, but also there can be very small things that can happen like this. And it can be as simple as being in rush hour traffic, late to get where you need to go, and somehow, you know, bumper-to-bumper traffic going slowly, inching away forward, and there's this green light up ahead, and your cars are standing still, but then some go, and they stand still, and you're like, I have to get that green light. And lo and behold, it turns red, and you're the last person who didn't get across. And it's like, you know, eight road intersection. It's going to be a long time before it comes back to you. And you're hot and irritated and impatient and tense. And you're by yourself in the car. Now, who in the world are you going to blame? The traffic light, the other drivers, the city planners? You know. I mean, who's responsible that moment? And you might at some point dawn on you, you look around, there's no one else I can turn to. It's all in here, myself. It's completely what I'm doing to myself. And then maybe, just maybe, you're able to let go. Let go of the impatience. Let go of at least the tension, the way you're kind of holding the steering wheel. The way you're kind of like riding the gas pedal and the brake at the same time, like just waiting to go. And settle back. and relax a little bit. And then you know something. You had a little liberation, little release from the holding, the tension, the pushing. And then if you know that, and see, oh, look at that. I've always been blaming the world and looking outside to how to fix things. But here, I did something amazing. I turned around and looked at myself, and I saw. This is possible. I think that this is interesting to do more often when I'm driving, or other times. Maybe I don't have to always be caught in the grip of my impatience and anger and aversion. And so then it becomes this, the path opens then. Oh, this is possible. And what it took was a lot of, then this is the knowledge part, you know. It's possible to end this tension, this holding, and this is what it takes. It takes turning attention back and really looking at what I'm doing here. There's no one else who's going to do this for me. So you come to the end of this retreat, and here also, there might have been moments in the retreat where something fell away. Temporarily, something fell away, some tension, some holding, some preoccupation. Maybe you came with some preoccupation at the beginning of the retreat, and it faded away. And at some point, halfway through the retreat, or yesterday or something, it wasn't really visiting, you gripped anymore, and it's possible just to kind of appreciate that and attribute it to good luck and, you know, get ready to pick it all up again at the end of the retreat, and, you know, you're refreshed so you can go back and get attached better. Or you could, and this is, I think, really what we is to appreciate that, yes, something was put down, and this is a possibility, it's a potential. And maybe understand a little bit what it took, or understand how valuable this is, that it's an important thing to be able to let go of something and not be caught in the grip, and that this is something that you see as a potential, something you want to aim towards in the future. Something you want to use as a reference point. Any sense of calm or ease or freedom that you attain, even if it goes away, can become a useful reference point to help us see more clearly when we pick it up again. So here we come to the end of the retreat, and some of you have already picked up your life again. And you've picked up maybe your personality again. That's, you know, kind of abated a little bit. And the thoughts begin to speed up. And at some point, think of the end's in sight, start thinking about the world we're going to go back to and life we're going to go back to. And it's fairly common for people to think that, well, you know, so much for the retreat. I guess it's over. You know, because retreat, what it is going deep down into the depths of stillness or something. That's really what counts. And when you come out, then it doesn't count. Like, you might as well just kind of, you know, I guess I'm supposed to stay to the end and I'll just make do, and, you know, it's like, it's, you know, basically over, and maybe I can do crossword puzzles in my head. And but actually it's very important, this transition time, because there's you can watch how things come back, and hopefully you can see it from a little different vantage point. You can see that it's not embedded, it's not required. You can see that some of the reasons why it comes back, some of the causes, some of the beliefs or attitudes or emotions that come into play get triggered. We can see what our relationship to these things are, how much we believe our thoughts or believe our emotions suddenly. We weren't so much believing them before, but now they really count. How quickly the old habits of how to deal with challenges come into play. And, you know, how could Gil have mentioned the end of the retreat the evening before, the afternoon before? Gil just kind of ruined my retreat. I think I'm going to have to write to the, you know, the head of IRC and tell Gil, you know, that know, that you don't mess with my retreat so early. Or maybe the habit is to blame yourself. Oh, I blew it, you know, I'm just a failure. Here's more proof, you know. I kind of had it for a couple of days or a couple of minutes there. And now I'm just a mess and I'm swirling, my thoughts are swirling, and it's just proof that I must be a failure. That's another strategy, right? There's all kinds of strategies. But the vantage point, to see it clearly, take the time, be really mindful. It's almost like more important to be mindful now than it was going into the retreat and kind of going on. Because it's possible to see how it all works, see how the software, the hardware works, how it all comes together. Because it's kind of a little bit thinner, it's a little bit more space for it, there's a little bit more mindfulness, there's a little bit more reference point to see it. And so even though it gets more busy and active and agitated, to continue to practice now is golden. It's really, really good. And don't allow yourself to get discouraged because it's more active and not as pleasant. So the word, one of the words that's used for liberation is release. And I like this word a lot, release. Because we're being released from the way we're caught, entangled, preoccupied. Being released from our suffering, from our contraction, from the heaviness that we have, maybe. So it's kind of release, something kind of gives way. The tradition also talks about becoming untied. So you have these knots, and the knots become untied, get released. And that idea of release is kind of it's an action of release. It's an activity of release. And the primary way in which freedom is talked about by the Buddha was not as a state, but as an activity of release. You don't get that so much in some of the English translations. Like many times when the word nirvana is used, or nibbana is used in the text, like the English translations use the word nibbana, and it looks like they're just not translating the original. They are kind of translating the original. The original is a verbal noun, not a pure noun. Like nirvana is a noun, and the original word is to be nirvanized. But that's, you can't say that in English. Like, you know, he was nirvanized, and so they translate it as attained nirvana. But then we think, oh, nirvana is a thing. I have to attain nirvana, that thing, that state, that, you know, that's the thing to get. But it's an activity, it's a movement of release. Maybe you don't get anything. It's not a state, it's a movement of freedom, of letting go of the clinging, the holding, just this movement. And then whatever follows can be what it is. And so we begin understanding that the path out of the wilderness resides in ourselves with the release, the grip that we have, the holding we have, the resistance we have. And release goes in contrast to the quest for relief. And it's important to see these two as being different. Many people are looking for relief, not release. So you're lost in the wilderness, and you come to a nice little lake with a nice sandy beach and a hammock and lemonade, and you kind of like lay down, and oh, this is nirvana. You know, I've arrived. This is it. You know, I don't need anything more. But you're still in the wilderness. It's just kind of a relief. So people carry a lot of tension. They carry a lot of angst, a lot of struggles. And sometimes people are content with somehow not freeing themselves of it, but putting aside, kind of getting relief from it, or ignoring it, or getting distracted from it, or get some kind of pleasure or some kind of activity that's stronger, so it kind of hides the tension or the suffering we have. And it can work sometimes for a while, but usually it catches up to us sooner or later, and we discover we're still in the wilderness, we still have all that stuff. And so to mature a form of spirituality is to stop and not settle for relief. See, relief is good sometimes, but to really sooner or later to be able to stop and really kind of turn around and see what's really here. Who am I? What am I doing? What's my adding? What am I? How am I reacting? How am I responding? How am I relating? What is it that I'm in conflict with? How am I in conflict with things? And this is important, this idea, because I think that human life has inherent tensions in it. That just comes with being human. And if we're only trying to get relief, we end up kind of staying in this world of tension. So what I mean by this is that one of the tensions that I think many people experience is a tension between being an individual and being part of a group. And some people, you know, have emphasized one more than the others, some cultures emphasize one more than the others, but it's really a spectrum or a range where people are at different times. And there are times with some people, I think everyone probably is more towards the wanting to be individual and alone and independent, and other times they're in the more on the side where they want to be part of a group and be connected and, you know, to a group. And it can flow, you know, if someone wants to really be an individual, so they go all the way over there to be, you know, individual, and they find they're lonely. And so then they're lonely, so then they go, I want to be around people. So they go back and to, you know, their people and all your possible relatives in a one-room cabin, snowed in for winter, you know, you have to, you know, and no shower, right? You know, it's great social time. You know, it's, you know, I need some time alone. You know? And so where do we, is there a sweet spot? Is there an ideal spot on that range from being complete individual to complete, you know, connected to community? And I don't think there's one spot. I think that there's always going to find some, you know, it's maybe for a moment there's a sweet spot, but it's always shifting and changing. And then it shifts because there's a little tension one way or the other. So if we look for relief, we might just go from one end to the other end of that spectrum, but then it kind of chases us, you know, that lasts for a little while and then doesn't work. There is the idea of kind of being your own person in American society, kind of is often kind of a big deal, be your own person. So I might decide that I'm going to really stand for myself and be a strong individual and do my own decisions and really kind of, you know, be free of all this social stuff and I don't want to be tied to what everyone else is doing and have to, you know, agree to all these rules that have to play in our society. And there's all this clear ways you're supposed to be, and it's so exacting. You know, it's just too much. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to make up my own language, because the rules of the English language are too much, and I have to be kind of, you know, I have to, you know, conform so dramatically, and now I'm becoming a slave to Microsoft spell check, and, you know, it's just like I'm just tied in too much. You know, I'm just going to go make my own language. That's great, but the purpose of language is to communicate. If no one else knows it, it's not going to work, right? So this idea of being an individual can be overdone, but the idea of being, you know, the other direction can be overdone. Another kind of tension that can happen is, especially when you're involved in practice like this, but also in life in general, is the tension between discipline and permissiveness, allowing acceptance and, you know, being strict, you know, having rules and kind of following them and maintaining them. And I think there also there's a spectrum, because if we're, you know, rules and discipline is often very useful, but then people can get contracted and tight, and it can be overdone, or it can be done in the wrong place, in the wrong time, and the wrong circumstances, and so it's not adaptive enough. So then people say, well, but, you know, I want to be permissive and allowing. And I benefited from this when I went to graduate school, because my advisor went to a graduate program that was very strict, had all these things, classes and hoops you had to go through, and all this stuff. So he wasn't going to pass that on. So when I showed up my first advisor session with my advisor, he said, Gil, it was before I signed up for the first class in graduate school, he said, Gil, I believe that graduate students just have lots of time just to read, go to the library and get books and have time to read, and I'm going to give you 4 units of credit and an A just so you can go read. And and that's the last I heard of it. And you know, my first guaranteed A in graduate school was I didn't do anything for it. I don't know, you know, the reading, what reading? I was taking care of the other classes. So I, you know, did I take advantage of it? I don't know what I did, but you know, it was nice. I got the little reprieve the first you know, semester. And I became way too loose, right? But now I'm kind of a professor of graduate school, right? And have I done that for anybody? No, I think it should be a little bit tighter. You know, that's too loose. No. And the pendulum swings, and there's tension in this room already, you see? Because these things have tension, right? They switch and go and all that, so. And then there's a tension between innovation and tradition, right? And innovation is great. Tradition is great. They each have their time, the time and place for them. But do they always get along? And different people, how does that work? And so people then argue and discuss, and even within ourselves, we have tension. So what I'm proposing here is that there are all kinds of tensions that exist for us, dualities for being a human being. And the usual approach is to kind of stay on the spectrum, stay in the tension, and just try to duke it out, or find where there's relief, or go to one extreme, or hold on to position, and somehow think that that's going to make it easier. The liberation that the Buddha is talking about is not relief, is not adjusting, not kind of somehow just coping with the inherent tensions with being a human being, but is stepping off the spectrum, the range, stepping off the game, and finding oneself, one's well-being, one's peace, one's sense of self, one's sense of freedom, that's not tied to where we fit in that range, where the tension is. Doesn't mean the tension goes away, but it means that we don't identify with it. We don't make it our happiness dependent on it. And we start seeing our relationship to those issues. And so it's not so important for purposes of liberation, it's not so important where you fit in those and how you answer the questions of where you fit on that spectrum. What's important is how you relate to it. Kind of how you step back and look at it. And when you look at it, what's your relationship? Do you lean into it? Do you hold on to it? Are you ready to, you know, you run away from it? What do you do? What's your relationship? And then can you find a relationship to it where there is no conflict, no contention, no overwhelm? You realize that the world has its challenges and unsatisfactory aspects. You realize there are tensions that we have to live in. But we can kind of use the power of mindfulness to step away and see clearly what's going on, but more importantly, see what our relationship is to it. See what our relationship is to this world and how we live our lives. And then in that relationship to it all, find our freedom. Because if freedom's really going to be thorough and complete, it's something that should be portable, that we bring with us to all aspects of our life, any place that we encounter. And the thing that we bring with us that's portable is our relationship to experience, to the situation. And that's where the key is for liberation. What kind of relationship do you have to it? What is the attitude? What is the reactivity? Is there, in the kind of simple language of Buddhism, is there clinging, grasping? Is there craving? Is there resistance? Is there aversion, hostility? Is there confusion? Is there shutting down? Is there going numb? Is there running around in circles? What's the relationship there? And rather than solving all the problems of our life, the place of portability, of applicability, universal applicability, has to do here in our hearts and how our hearts sit in relationship to what goes on around us. And so here's where we look. And we start looking deeply. And one of the things that we can see is when there is suffering, when there is conflict and tension, there's something embedded in our hearts. The Buddha said, in a very famous poem, he said, before he was enlightened, he looked at the world and he was dismayed by all the violence and all the change and challenges that existed in the world. And he found no place that he could call his own, no place that he could stand in this crazy world. And people are running around. And then he said, and then I saw, deeply embedded in the heart, an arrow. And when the arrow is removed, then there's freedom. The arrow is removed, the heart is settled. And so at some point to really, to turn around, what is it here? What's the relationship? Now, if you want to know how to study where the relationship is and where it really makes a difference, you want to be able to be sensitive to your suffering. And the bumper sticker for Buddhists is, I stop for suffering. not to see suffering as bad news, but to turn towards it and see what is going on here? What's really happening here? Where's the tension? Where's the holding? Where's the resistance? What is in my heart in relationship to all this? And part of the function of like retreat and practice is to get quiet enough and still enough, not so you can have blissful experiences, but so you can really start seeing, touching, caring for the depth of your being. What is there? And to be able to pull out the arrow of conflict, pull out the arrow of fear, pull out the arrow of conceit, pull out the arrow of delusions of grandeur, pull out the arrows of fear and resentment and whatever's there. It takes a lot of, I think, dedication to do this thoroughly. It takes courage. I like to think that it takes dignity. It's a dignified approach to sit there and to be willing to do this. And it's possible to then experience this release. Not relief, but release. To find our freedom. So we're free from everything, but free from obligations, free from responsibilities, free from institutions, free from other people's demands, free from other people's expectations, free from our own expectations. free from wanting to please people, wanting to be liked by people, free from trying to run away from people and hide ourselves from people. We really be freed. And then, as I said last night, to be freed from obligation and responsibility, it seems outrageous. Free from responsibility, what an outrageous thing to say. But I think we have a response ability. We have an ability to respond and to trust the heart's response ability, I think, is the path of freedom. To be responsible sometimes closes the heart. It becomes a burden too quickly. So it's a radical thing, this whole approach, because it's a very, very different way of living our lives than how we normally live our lives. And so we're back to faith, trust. Trusting it's okay to not be in contention. Trusting it's okay not to be in conflict. Trusting it's okay just to be. Just to be. Nothing to prove, nothing to defend, nothing to apologize for. Just be. And then, as it's appropriate, as the heart is moved, to respond. Free of the parental voices or societal voices, it says, oh, you're supposed to, you should. So to start becoming aware, start becoming appreciative of whatever experience of release you have, release of tension, release of holding, release of craving, and use that as a North Star, use that as a teacher for yourself. That be the place where you discover your own path. In the end, the idea is you become your own teacher by having a reference point in your own heart of what it's like to be free. So look for that. Look for the small places. Look for the small little things. Don't underestimate even what might be teeny, teeny little movement of freedom, that how valuable it is. And I'll give you, I don't know if it's a teeny example, but I'll give you an example from a retreat I sat. I'd been in Asia, and where we sat kind of without a schedule, and I would sometimes sit for long periods of time. It was very nice. And I was used to, if I sit, longer than, a long period of time, then I can get more settled and peaceful and concentrated, and it was nice. And then I came and did a retreat here in California, and I decided that in this retreat that I would follow the bell. When the bell rang at the end of the sitting, I'd get up and walk. Bell rang to go back to end the walking, I'd go back to sit. And part of me is like, the bell would ring in a sitting, I said, oh, but I'm just starting to warm up here. But I would get up. And what I discovered was that the subtle holding and wanting meditation experience that I had, getting something, and it was kind of painful to have that. But what was more wonderful was that there was a kind of a joy in letting go of that. Just letting go of whatever I was holding on to, whatever I was expecting, whatever I was wanting. I'll just let go and start fresh next moment. Get up and walk. And that joy of just kind of responding and not holding on to anything was the teaching of that particular retreat. So I don't know if that's small, but it's on the small end of scales of a certain kind of freedom, the freedom of following the bell, as opposed to following my preferences or my desires. So look for the opportunities for yourself to find, to have experiences of release, of liberation, of some degree at all. And I'm confident all of you have that in your life. Find where it is, appreciate it, get a taste for it, get the feel for it, and then take that feel and expand it so it's bigger. Take that sooty little light bulb, and we look for the little pinhole, little places where the light kind of, you know, shines through, and then begin to kind of polish it around there and clean it around there and begin expanding it into more and more areas of your life. And over time, gradually, slowly, steadily, your light bulb, your heart, will shine a lot. That's the hope. That's the possibility. So liberation, and then knowing you're liberated, knowing what you've let go of, and using that to further the path, further the practice further. Use that as a teacher for yourself as you go on and on.